Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Today I'm joined by Hans-Georg Müller, who's a professor in the Philosophy and Religious Studies program at University of Macau. Some of you may know of his channel Carefree Wandering. I'd highly recommend checking it out. It has quite an interesting and diverse catalog of videos. Would you like to introduce yourself also?
You basically said the most important things. Thanks.
Okay. So I think the best place to maybe start would be to kind of talk about, because we're both in the business of this to varying degrees, kind of the commodification of philosophy and democratizing education online. And I'm kind of wondering about your own assessment of the sort of pros and cons of doing this.
Right. Yeah. As you said, I mean, like with basically everything else in the world, it's an ambiguous phenomenon that we have. On the one hand, there is the, you know, philosophy is kind of firmly entrenched within the academic industry, as I like to call it, especially in North America. So we have lots of academically trained philosophers who compete for very few jobs, and they have to kind of compete one another on the basis of, for instance, showing up in academic conferences that they often have to pay quite high conference fees for, and they have to compete for publishing articles in academic journals. So this has become some form of systematized, industrialized context, which actually takes, I would say, is not very productive overall for doing philosophy and for doing intellectual work. It has produced, I guess, a lot of frustration among people who kind of naturally have an interest in philosophy. Then on the other hand, of course, we have stuff that we do. We have people doing philosophical contents, introducing philosophical contents, discussing philosophical context on social media in one way or another, blogs or podcasts or YouTube channels and something like this. And generally, I think that's obviously a positive thing, because it kind of makes philosophy not necessarily popular. Usually these channels don't get that many views or not that many attention, but it definitely makes it a much more lively and, communicationally active thing. So that's very good. But of course, even there, certain elements of our contemporary society play an important role. That is, like, again, commercialization, in the sense that, of course, everything that's on social media is somehow mined for data. The whole context that is geared towards making people basically addicted, right? That's how the whole system is set up. This kind of vying for attention a general kind of focus on maybe more on the presenter than on presenting them, on what is presented. So this is just a few things about the pros and cons of academic philosophy and philosophy on popular channels.
Yes, and it's interesting bringing up the kind of the emphasis on the presenter and maybe the aesthetics of the presentation of philosophy and other ideas compared to maybe the actual content. And I think it kind of, that you've talked about this, this is a very bold distinction compared to academic philosophy, in that the academic presenter doesn't necessarily climb the ladder of academia because of their charisma or charm necessarily, or their really bright personality or their editing skills or anything like that. It's usually they have a certain amount of technical training and intimate knowledge with the content that has went through various checks like institutional checks within universities and amongst other technically gifted professors and academics, whereas anybody can make a YouTube channel, and it seems to be more of the people that are kind of able to capture the sort of addictiveness these social media platforms kind of thrive on. And I'm kind of wondering if maybe one of the kind of elements that leads to this sort of capturing of attention from the presenter, one of the effective kind of methods that presenters use, is this sort of appeal to authenticity that you also talk about, that we tend to like presenters who are being genuine or authentic. And the whole kind of draw of YouTube is this idea of being genuine. And it's a bit more personal, a bit more amateur than television or traditional forms of media, or as mentioned, academic institutions, if you'd like to talk about that.
Right. I think one shouldn't underestimate, to contradict a little bit, if I may, what you said at the beginning, the role of what you call charisma in an academic context. One could also find more neutral or perhaps even negative words for this, right? I mean, just like in any other context, also in academic philosophy, at least as I experienced it, or generally in the arts and humanities, the kind of art of presenting yourself is also is very important, right? So it's not just, knowing a lot and reading a lot and studying a lot. It's very much also the way of presenting yourself. And this has led to kind of absurd consequences. I always remember this story, which an older philosophy friend told me, that he was a student of Adorno back in Germany in the late 1960s, early 70s. Anyways, and it's a short story, but and he told it to me many decades ago. But I think the story is very kind of representative for what's going on in the academia. And the story is the following. He was a student, and there was kind of a guest lecturer, visiting lecturer, and he couldn't go. And then it was in Frankfurt. And he asked a friend who had actually been to the lecture, how was it? And the friend said, without irony, it was great. I didn't understand a word. that was this kind of posture that I still experienced in German philosophy, and especially in German academic philosophy, which is kind of inherited from the German tradition, like with Hegel and Kant, right? That you have to express yourself in a very difficult to understand manner, and the better you can do that, the higher your prestige is. This is of course very different from what is now expected on YouTube or on on social media, but it's also a form like where mannerisms were have always been very important, there's a lot of imposters in academia, just as there are a lot of imposters everywhere else. But nevertheless, that's just a gradual difference. Of course, there are also the kind of the quality check mechanisms in place that you mentioned. So the situation is kind of complex. Now, you were talking about the notion of authenticity. And that's a core idea that I'm using in my own philosophy. And my basic idea that I expressed in a number of books and videos is the following. Namely, that we moved on from an age of authenticity, that's a phrase used or expression used by the philosopher Charles Taylor, to what I call an age of prophylicity. So in short, this basically means, authenticity is basically the pursuit of originality. And it means that you have a certain notion of the individual person, of personal identity as an individual, and each individual has to somehow pursue originality and to find yourself or create yourself. And in this way, you shape really a valid identity. I argue that this kind of model or this kind of technology for shaping selfhood, which is still the technology that I grew up with and is still very, very important, is being gradually replaced by a different way of shaping your identity, your personal identity, of shaping who you are, namely that is through creation of profiles and then present these profiles often to what I call a general peer, that is some form of anonymous larger public. And then you get some kind of social feedback validation mechanisms emerge and the profile gets validated and thereby you get your profile validated. And I do think that this transition from the mode of authenticity to the mode of profilicity is visible everywhere in society. So I don't think most people are just simply authentic anymore, especially not if they're in social media, but, and this is very important, also not in academia. In academia too, you have to create a profile. You have to do it with different means than you do on social media. I mentioned these things like, you know, you have to basically create a CV and go to the right conferences and publish in the right journals and so forth, right? Generally, I think this is a transition that we see throughout society. And somehow on social media, and that's why I somehow like the format actually, it's kind of ironically more obvious, right? We are there in the mode of profilicity is more obvious than it is maybe in academia. So I would, again, sorry for contradicting you there too somewhat. I would say that even though, of course, as you rightly said, the social media presenters, they often appear more kind of amateurish and so forth. But nevertheless, I mean, it's clearly staged, it's clearly edited, and you become kind of your own in an amateurish way. You become your own kind of TV celebrity now. Of course, it's social YouTube celebrity, but you follow somehow them. You try to, the presenters, and me too, right? We try to create this profile of like a small-time celebrity.
Okay. No, that's very interesting. And I think what I meant was more so that presenters aren't necessarily being authentic. It's that they're selling a sort of authenticity,
right,
that the audience does know that it's, you know, probably not the whole truth. Like, right, when we watch, and sometimes, I mean, it's on a continuum. There's some, you know, there's vloggers who they will film every day of their life and every moment of their life, and that might come with it a more kind of a seemingly sincere form of authenticity versus somebody who would, you know, maybe sit down and maybe act like a TV presenter, and they're kind of you can tell they're kind of putting it on. And in both forms, they're not, I would argue, they're not really being authentic.
No.
But what I'm curious about is that we're aware of the fact that their profiles,
right,
and that, you know, to a certain degree we're being fed this inauthentic kind of character to us,
right?
But at the same time, what I feel like when I watch these is that the appeal is the fact that there's this authenticity. It's a bit like I think it's Frankfurt's like On Bullshit, where it's like maybe not necessarily, you know, they're not expecting us to fully believe that all of this is authentic, and we know also for the most part that it's not all authentic, but there's something kind of alluring still about using authenticity to kind of attract an audience for a profile, in order to promote a profile,
right?
If that kind of clarifies it.
Of course, definitely, that's definitely the case. I mean, authenticity in the service of profilicity. That is definitely the case. Just to address this a little bit further, a big difference from actual authenticity to profilicity is also that if you're like completely operating in the mode of traditional authenticity, then you're also looking for other authentic individuals, and that cannot really take place on media. right? You need to actually be present with other authentic individuals whose, the term coming from Hegel would be whose recognition you're looking for. And you have to develop some form of deep relation with them, right? But of course, that's not the point if you go on social media. You want as many viewers as possible, and you don't want to know them. You don't have the time or the will, you know, to authentically know your viewers. You want the viewers to validate your profile. So that is completely different, right? As opposed to many other kind of more traditional thinkers, I do not want to say that authenticity is somehow better than profilicity, or that it's, and I'm also not saying it's somehow more real. I think they all have their problems, all these technologies of identity. They all have paradoxical, strongly paradoxical elements. And they're just different technologies to shape an identity, and they work in different ways, and they correspond also maybe to different social circumstances. So when we call something inauthentic, then we just basically use this term from the perspective of authenticity. We're authenticity biased, right? So there are certain elements that are inauthentic, and I just mentioned one about social media presentation, namely that you're not really looking for other authentic individuals, and you're not looking for the recognition by them. But to do so would be absurd on social media, right? So it's not a bad thing. It's not somehow a character flaw or so, right? It's just applying a different technology, which from the perspective of authenticity could be called inauthentic. But that doesn't mean that it's in and of itself bad. Because you were also talking like ambiguously and partly positively about what's going on YouTube, namely that that the presenters have this kind of honesty or so about them, at the same time where the honesty is clearly staged. So it's kind of this kind of ambiguous staged honesty. And why does that appeal to us? Well, I guess it appeals to us in a similar way because we're used to this, whatever, from Instagram and Facebook or whatever, from other forms of interaction that has just become a common mode of shaping your identity. And why shouldn't philosophy follow? I mean, right, why shouldn't philosophy adopt the same mode of communication that is prevalent in other forms of life, right? Yeah, does it address what you said?
Yes, I think so, and I guess it would probably be just an appeal to. It would be maybe the same thing as answering why authenticity was at one point under your like definition, speaking in like kind of past terms. Authenticity was a popular mode of kind of. I guess media communication of, you know, it was the moral of a lot of stories, a lot of philosophies is maybe, I guess it offers like a sense of stability. And now because we're maybe hyper cognizant and hyper aware of kind of like a, maybe a sort of meta narratives and kind of promised sources of stability, that authenticity seems a little bit archaic now,
right?
But we still have kind of those maybe, primitive mechanisms that we kind of want to, we still nonetheless like that kind
right.
of sense Absolutely. Of stability. Yes. So profilicity, like these like YouTube channels, or social media accounts, for example, they kind of satisfy the kind of more primal, like drives for stability, while also kind of satisfying our intellectual capacities to go like, oh, like, I know you're kind of lying to me. I know this isn't
right.
completely grounded in reality. If that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, if I may, I've been thinking about this a lot also because of my YouTube channel. Jordan Peterson, maybe the most successful social media philosopher, he has this message, which is the core message of authenticity, sovereign individuality, right? I mean, if is all his self-help books and his political philosophy and even his kind of pseudo-religious thinking, it all revolves around the shaping of the sovereign individual. And that's the, at least a, but I would even say the central theme of authenticity, right? That we all should be sovereign individuals. And that's kind of the model of the of personhood that we should kind of follow. But then at the same time, again, like Jordan Peterson is a clearly curated social media persona, right? And so I think he really embodies and manifests this contradiction that we were talking about, that is authenticity in the service of profilicity. And it somehow expresses the contradiction of authenticity that I think was always there, but that is now more and more obvious, namely that authenticity is anything but authentic. It's copied from models of authenticity, right? That has always been the case, right? Whatever we read about authenticity in novels, and we then later on saw examples of authenticity in movies, and then we were listening to models of authenticity. We saw them in movies, and then we were listening to it in music, right? So many songs about authenticity, right? And that's kind of the core paradox in authenticity. And the paradox becomes kind of very obvious in social media, that originality is not really original and that authenticity is not really authentic. And I think Peterson, manifests this. Also, again, like the self-help thing, right? Sell millions of books that tell everyone to become a sovereign individual, right? So following basically the same method. In a sense, that's kind of... So authenticity becomes, I think, less and less credible. And also a lot of people are very kind of suspicious of Jordan Peterson, right? He not only has a lot of fans, he also has a lot of people who don't like him. And of course, people do usually don't like him for political reasons. But I think really this kind of putting authenticity in the service of profilicity is something that I find like super suspicious about him. And then... On the other hand, you have then these YouTubers who, ContraPoints or so, who are kind of very clearly just staging themselves in an extreme manner. But in some way, this comes across as more authentic, so to speak. It's no longer authentic; it's actually profilic. But it's somehow in a weird way more honest, because they actually, in a very playful way and in an enjoyable way and in a smart way, play and display the profile curation and make it obvious, make it visible. And that's somehow more honest than it on the same media is still kind of spreading the gospel of sovereign individuality.
Yeah, and I think that I'm not even sure if it's entirely political, the grievance that a lot of people have with Peterson might be that he is stating that the sovereign individual is the best, someone that is autonomous, that is free. Right. And I do think that he is kind of his definition of freedom is a little bit restrictive. Like it's to use kind of Isaiah Berlin's like two liberties. There's negative liberty, which is basically you should be free to do what you want. You should be absent of direct control or coercion. And that's one liberty, but Peterson's is more of like it's positive liberty, where it's like you are free to then become kind of these very specific things that are grounded in, Jungian archetypes and evolutionary psychology. And if I've always wondered if his like argument, like if somebody was to clean their room and to really take care of themselves and, become a sovereign individual, and then they became Marxist, if he would still see that as them being authentically themselves. Like it feels like he has very, kind of narrow definitions of exactly like what this sovereign individual will look like.
Sure.
And yes. Yeah, and I think that that might reveal a bit of the issue with authenticity that he has. It's his authenticity.
Right.
Yeah,
it's not really his, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it is his. You're right, but it's not just, or it's not original, right? It's also mm-hmm. kind of the mainstream standard conservative, as he now calls it, ideal of sovereign individuality.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I think I remember. There was a video you did, and then I think he responded in the comments with like quite a long like addressing each and every point. I don't know if you want to talk about that, and I don't recall if there was a follow up or anything, but that was interesting.
He did send this angry kind of message to me. It was surprised, of course, very good for my profile, right? So I was very thankful that he did this, and I did say a few things that were not really, I think, adequate in my first video on he did, which he then reacted to. I don't even remember. It was mm-hmm. the first, maybe it was the second, and so I think he got a point. But of course, his reaction was over the top. I mean, the words, and it's just like Trump tweeting at 5 a.m. or so, right? And, that he even, you know, noticed my channel and that it made him so angry and emotional. And that he then took the time to respond and type. So that shows a lot of his kind of character, I guess. And then I responded, and it helped me to kind of improve my critique of him. So mm-hmm. yeah, that was an interesting little thing. And in the initial video that I made, I didn't really focus enough on the sovereign individual notion, which is really at the center of what he says. So it helped me mm-hmm. to clarify that.
And I don't know. It might have been, from what I sensed, maybe the fact that you are also like both in the intersection of, you know, academic credentials and also like in an online space with a profile. And,
right.
You know, that might have been why he was focusing on that channel in particular, because there are a lot of
be true. Yes.
That yeah.
Very well be true.
But I also I want to focus on it's interesting when you brought up also ContraPoints, because it is very theatrical and right. Very over the top kind of it's similar to this might be a little on the nose, but when like Judith Butler kind of talks about drag queens and right. their kind of their over performativeness kind of is as like a pastiche. So it's not really like a satire necessarily, but it's a pastiche in that it's kind of ironically pointing out the fact that there are no true origins or there is no true right. essence, and it's playing right. around with that. And yes. I think that, you know, this lends quite nicely with your kind of critique of authenticity in that it's right. There are no true origins. They're just kind of reflections of previous things bouncing off of each other.
Exactly the point. Yes.
I'm wondering, because you bring up genuine pretending, and I'm wondering if that's maybe a better way to kind of conceptualize this.
Yes. The notion of genuine pretending, I have to give a little context of that. That is actually a term coined by Paul D'Ambrosio, with whom I wrote a book on Taoism and then later the book on Profelicity. So the notion of genuine pretending is originally our understanding of early Chinese Taoist philosophy. And we think that basically genuine pretending is it's a term, we coined the term, but we use the term again to describe what we think is a basic insight in Taoist philosophy in what could be called a general kind of existential mode of everyone mm-hmm. All the time. Everyone is genuinely pretending, in the sense that pretending also in English has like the notion of play, right? You in child play, you pretend whatever to be a king or a queen. And that basically social life is always a form of pretending, and that in this pretense, we develop genuineness, and that this is the case for everyone basically all the time. And so this kind of, again, ambiguous insight into, let's say, the, again, like it's an intentional contradiction, right, into the pretense that is the foundation of genuineness, that informs our critique of, for instance, authenticity. Now, you're absolutely right. This kind of what Judith Butler describes as performativity, and then also with regard to the queer community, and then with regard to contrapoints, this is somehow can be, but not necessarily is, but it definitely has the potential to kind of be more, how to say, truthful in that sense to this general mode of genuine pretending that we all share. So this is something that I at least potentially like about Profelicity, right? That it kind of makes this existential condition of genuine pretending, which is at the center of everyone's identity and of everyone's existence, that makes it somehow more obvious. But of course, unfortunately, there are also all kinds of problems with Profelicity, right? Because one gets then easily obsessed with the creation of a profile. It becomes a kind of a narcissistic activity, and all kinds of pressures and profile competitions and whatnot also arises. So it's not really the case that Profelicity is actually better than authenticity or sincerity. It has its pitfalls, but it also has its benefits. And the benefit that I outlined, its kind of connection with genuine pretending, I would say is something that's interesting about Profelicity, and that somehow also allows it to be a competitor of authenticity, and maybe even be regarded as in some ways more interesting than authenticity.
I'm not sure if it has much relation, but at least on like a social level, this sort of genuine pretending and even Profelicity, I wonder if it maybe shares some sort of familiarity with liminality, like as Victor Turner kind of discusses it, where you kind of have these different groups that for ritualistic purposes or rites of passage, they kind of enter into these liminal spaces where they're genuinely pretending, where they, typically perform or act or disguise themselves as members of the society that they wouldn't typically represent, or even kind of mythological creatures. And they do this for the purpose of kind of destabilizing hierarchy and typical relations in order to kind of come around and further appreciate or further solidify those kind of the sort of social cohesion of the group. I'm not sure if it's, I don't know if it's directly related, but it came to mind when I was watching you talk about this.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the term liminality used to be very fashionable for a while, and I never thought about it in this way, to be honest, but how you explained it, it makes a lot of sense. We were using the notion of a carnivalesque, which is by Bakhtin, the old Russian thinker, which is somewhat similar, right? Again, genuine pretending is not, maybe unlike liminality, an exceptional state. Everyone is genuinely pretending all the time. Mm. But of course, most people don't realize that they are genuinely pretending. They just think and aspire to become genuine in one way or another, according to the technology that they are using, right? And if you're operating in the mode of authenticity, you try to be genuinely authentic. If what we call sincerity, that is a role-oriented form of identity shaping, where you shape your identity by basically following family roles or other social roles, right? You try to be whatever, truly manly or true, a good mother or something, or a good son. And thereby you try to achieve genuineness by committing fully to your role. And nowadays you try to achieve genuineness by whatever, being fully invested in your profile. Right. Mm. So basically, genuine pretending is a state we're always in, but most people don't really know that they are genuinely pretending, but in one way or another aspire pure genuineness. And genuine pretending is basically a philosophical insight into the fact that genuineness is always a construct. Genuineness is always pretended. There is no such thing as pure genuineness. And in this sense, what you said about liminality does make sense, that it is kind of a temporary acknowledgement and a temporary practice of genuine pretending that acknowledges the ambiguity of both genuineness and pretense. But then liminality somehow supposes that maybe people then get out of it again, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas we would say everyone is genuine pretending all the time. It's just most of the time people don't know that.
Mm, okay. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And to maybe return to, because we did discuss, you know, genuine pretending and the positives of profelicity, but you also mentioned the negatives, such as like the narcissism. And, maybe, I'm not sure if you've directly used this term, but almost kind of like an identity fundamentalism, where people become overly attached to their identity, generally like they're online, they can become so obsessed with it. They could maybe... I don't want to say lose touch with themselves, but kind of it becomes like pathologized. It becomes a little bit unhealthy in different ways.
Right. Yes. And that's the case with any of the identity technologies, right? You can be overcommitted to your role and you can whatever become a religious fundamentalist, or you can become a overly dedicated soldier, right? And you can overly commit to your role as whatever your female or male roles in the family. And in China, you can very much, which is still the case, be very much overcommitted to your role as a subservient child, right, in the family. And similarly, this kind of overly pursuit of originality and authenticity, right, this can also easily become pathological, right? And then you have this kind of histrionic personality who is just like original to a ridiculous extent, right? And then is also extremely full of themselves or so. And then in profelicity, what can happen is this kind of obsession in what then is often called narcissistic way with your profile, right? In one of the videos, I referred to this research by Jonathan Haidt, a famous kind of American social psychologist, who speaks about this kind of suicide wave and mental illness wave among teenage girls, especially, who use Instagram. In my view, this seems to be a clear case of pathological profile orientation. I mean, these kids are just learning how to be profilic, and then they can't really cope with it, and they become kind of overly anxious about their profile identity while shaping it. I mean, identity is often kind of most precarious when, as a teenager, you actually start shaping it. And then it seems that these girls, mostly girls, as the research shows, are kind of overwhelmed by the task of shaping a profile and just are incapable of coping with it.
So it's a prophylicity could offer the potential for genuine pretending, but it can also lead to an even, you know, a very extreme over obsession with one's identity. Would it be beneficial then to somehow, if more people were kind of comfortable with a transient sense of identity, or kind of like we're more aware of kind of one's identity as being somewhat illusory or kind of fragmented, and maybe just cared less in general, because I'm just thinking it would be quite difficult for people to not be egocentric. And it seems like these kind of different technologies of identity are just different ways of kind of coping with egocentrism and kind of contextualizing it, so someone could, you know, survive and go about their day-to-day lives. I'm kind of wondering if you think it's like if there's a potential world or potential actions to be taken to, like, on a personal level, on a social level, where someone could avoid this sort of like self-obsession or like kind of fundamentalism.
I mean, that's a central, what I call the Taoist element, which is in the West maybe better known under kind of the Buddhist successors of Taoism, right? Which is very much about, but in Tao, that's a big similarity between Taoism and Buddhism, that they are kind of challenging two rigid conceptions of selfhood, right? Mm-hmm. And so to kind of ease up the conception of selfhood, that's very much, I guess, at the center of Taoist and Buddhist philosophy. And I think that's also something that is very important today. Both it was important under conditions of authenticity, and it is important also under conditions of prophylicity. So, yes, basically, I'm just kind of affirming what you said earlier, that this is an important thing. And if there's kind of a therapeutic element to my kind of thinking or my philosophy, then it's precisely this. I regard Taoism and by extension Buddhism basically as therapeutic modes of philosophizing. The therapeutic aspect is precisely the a kind of easing of obsessions with selfhood. So yes, that's very much kind of the, if you would call it the ethical, but I would rather call it again a medicinal or therapeutic aspect of the philosophy.
And it's easier said than done, because I've noticed, and like to go Peterson, for example, like he will discuss Buddhism a lot in his, you know, lectures, for example, or his books, and he uses it as kind of a, you know, he talks about how the Buddha says life is suffering, and then from that he kind of skips a few steps and also talks about how Buddhism can help you kind of arrive at authenticity. And, and there is this sort of, I think it's called like Mick mindfulness in the West, where people will adapt, kind of the whole ego is an illusion or the self is an illusion, and they'll adapt certain meditative practices, but they'll do this in the service of actually kind of doubling down on certain identities. And there's a large neo-spiritual movement where people kind of want to be primarily attached to this movement. They want to be associated with it, which is somewhat ironic because it is.
But yes, and that you nailed it there. And that has always been a problem also in the Eastern tradition, but especially so in the Western tradition. And I couldn't agree more with what you said about Peterson and about this whole kind of phenomenon. I think very important, especially in Taoism, and I'm more Taoist than a Buddhist, is the function of humor in this. So that's, I guess, the culturally most important tool to relativize selfhood and identity, and to ease it up through the use of humor, right? Where you make fun of yourself and make fun of others and make fun generally, just make fun. Mm-hmm. And this kind of, and show the incongruities, that's at the center of humor, right? And this incongruity also shows the incongruities of your self constructions. And it, at the same time, it has, humor has this very strong therapeutic effect. And at the same time as well, it's not just something that you just do on your own, right? You just typically do it also together with others. So it's not a selfish thing. That's why I think that humor is also a very important therapeutic method. And again, interestingly, that's also something that Peterson seems to seriously lack.
No, that's I'm just thinking of the fact that, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one, but when you're with your friends know you kind of the most, and right. you tend to have your guard down. And first of all, typically I feel like myself is a lot more kind of loose and kind of fluid, yes, compared to being in like a meeting or you know, in on the subway or something. Right. And secondly, a lot of the humor in friendship interactions is typically kind of poking holes at the other person's identity, or kind of poking fun at kind of inconsistencies, yes, or insecurities. And I've never thought of humor as a tool. And I don't know, maybe it's just the lack of fun in Western, right, intellectualizing, but that's and I like that idea quite a bit. Because we're kind of, it's almost been about an hour. I'm kind of wondering, do you have any sort of further questions you've been tackling regarding prophylicity and authenticity, or if you feel like you've kind of developed a system of thought that you're kind of satisfied with?
No, I'm not really fully satisfied with it. This relation that we also talked about, that still, I think more can be said about the kind of curious relation between authenticity and prophylicity, and how authenticity is put in the service of prophylicity, and how the two relate to one another. I think that's a central problem generally of today's world. So I want to reflect more on this, and currently I'm doing it with regard to the notions of gender and transgender, which is I think also kind of an interesting, shows this paradox like in an interesting way, in the sense that, you know, people are supposed to affirm their true gender. That seems to be like an authenticity, is an authenticity vocabulary. But at the same time, the whole discourse seems to be very much about shape creating certain profiles, right? And mm-hmm. and what's important is not, you know, not just pronouns, but that our people are basically, that their profile is accepted in the way that somehow that society points out profiles need to be accepted. So I'm interested in analyzing this whole kind of gender transgender discourse, which is so important right now, from this from the perspective of the kind of, let's say, contradictions between authenticity and prophylicity. That's something I'm working on right now.
Mm-hmm. No, that's quite interesting. I recently did a video on, I'm not sure if you're familiar with kind of like the whole online space of the manosphere, of like a kind of their men's personal development kind of gurus. Right. Peterson would fit into this, but it's like a, right. Yeah. And they tend to be very averse and threatened by kind of transgender sure. people. And it's yeah. because it's very much, it would be interesting to get your thoughts on that, because they are, very much online profiles that are absolutely focused on preserving masculine authenticity, despite the whole idea of an authentic masculinity being very historically unstable and shifting constantly. I'm kind of wondering what you think of that.
Yes, that's interesting. Yeah, that makes total sense, right? That makes total sense. That there is, transgender is, but again, it's kind of completely paradoxical. That on the one hand, transgender is perceived as a threat to authenticity, but on the other hand, it is kind of promoted with an authenticity vocabulary,
mm-hmm.
right? That these people are more authentic than manly men.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, yes.
Right. And that the manly men are actually inauthentic. And in order to be truly authentic, you have to be, you know, you have to come out as your true transgender self.
Well, I think it's kind of a, like, I noticed a paradox with the manosphere in that it was very much gender essentialist, but they were very, also at the same time, the whole space exists to kind of get men to actually achieve masculinity. So in one hand, gender essentialism would kind of refute a lot of, you know, trans people, because they would see it as, no, you are like, you were born a certain gender, that's your gender. But then at the same time, a lot of like the manosphere advocates, they kind of, it's almost a social constructionist kind of viewpoint where it's, you're actually not born a man, you have to become a man by hitting certain checkpoints. And, you know, trans people, they kind of, they kind of skip the essentialist part and they achieve certain types of masculinity, maybe, and maybe this kind of confuses like manosphere advocates, but I just felt that was like a bit of a contradiction that kind of had to deal with authenticity, where
right
they were saying like you were born this way, but also you're not born this way, you have to achieve certain identity.
Yeah, right. And this kind of contradiction between being born I'm even more interested than, I'm interested in exactly this paradox. But another aspect of this paradox is the display element, right? That is so obvious, right? Like whatever in the pronouns and also in the focus on how the body looks and so forth, right? Mm. That it's clearly on the one end we have the vocabulary of authenticity. I'm born in this way. I've always been like this or that. On both sides, both in the manosphere and the transgender discourse, very heavily employ authenticity vocabulary. On the other hand, and I'm more familiar because I recently worked on it with the transgender kind of stuff, where there's also this emphasis on being seen as, being validated by the general peer, right? That this really becomes very much of concern, which is not really an authenticity thing, right? In the authenticity thing, you're just be who you are, and you're with your few authentic other friends, and that's enough. And basically everything in broader society is inauthentic and doesn't really matter, right? The public perception is kind of anyways somehow in authenticity. It's like Heidegger, das Mann, right? The they, that doesn't really count. It's not a source cannot be a source of validation. But in the transgender discourse, despite the vocabulary of authenticity, there is such a strong emphasis on what could be called public validation.
Now I do wonder with the last point, if it's maybe a bit of a selection bias, because we'd be more likely to hear from transgender individuals who specifically would, I don't consider this necessarily a negative thing, but they would seek out the validation from the public. So,
I'm working with practitioners, right? People mm-hmm. who are actually in working professionally with transgender transition and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me that there's a huge shift towards these kind of profilicity concerns, right? Mm-hmm. That actually a few years ago, usually people were transitioning didn't really care much about the pronouns, and now it's very much a concern. And similarly about, like, you know, how their body is perceived and so forth, that this is that there's in practice a big concern with profilicity aspects.
I guess, like, to kind of end it on kind of a larger question, but also kind of addressing this, because you're talking about there appears to be an evident shift in kind of profile concerns over authenticity concerns. What right. do you think kind of motivated this transition between the kind of relying on one's identity in terms of authenticity and now kind of caring more about one's profile? What do you think it's, I mean, it's likely
a very good question. I think it has to do, simply put, with the emergence of the brand, of branding, which in theoretical language that I'm using represents a shift from first to second order observation. So we were used to basically see the world in the mode of first order observation. That is, when you look at a shoe, you see a shoe. And when you buy a shoe, you go to the shoemaker and, mm-hmm. and buy a shoe. But then in the 19th and then especially 20th century, brands developed. And nowadays, we just don't see a shoe as a shoe. We see a shoe as whatever, Nike or Adidas or whatever, right? So we see the shoe through the profile of the shoe. And that has basically become, and you can call this, a technical term would be second order observation. You just don't observe simply the thing. You observe how the thing is observed, and you observe basically the observer of the thing. So the observation of has become much, much more complex. And the same thing is, you know, whatever in the economy or so, right, where because brand is basically a term from the economy, right, where through the development of markets and so forth. So we've basically switched to this second order observation mode. And again, this is in everything, also going back to what we talked about the beginning in academia, right? You see which university a person got their degree from and, you know, which journals they publish in and so forth. So this kind of looking at the world in the mode of second order observation, looking at something via its profile, has become common. Mm-hmm. And just therefore, accordingly, we also have to shape our image in the form of a profile. Right? We know it's so. The shift towards profilicity, theoretically speaking, is a shift from first order observation to second order observation, and it coincides with a shift from buying goods as things, or buying goods in, or goods as commodities, or buying goods as branded commodities. And mm-hmm. profilicity is some form of self-branding.
Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of, like, I mean, I think dating apps might be one of the best examples. Yeah, because it's like a kind of marketing yourself, and everybody knows that it's everyone's best photos, and, like, you know, it's not really who they are, but as long as it's, like, just enough, like, it's like a shiny enough package, then, you know, maybe someone will give you a chance, and then you know, time reveal.
It becomes actually primary, right? Mm-hmm. Because just as in the shoe, the primary thing is the brand, right? And the brand kind of guarantees the brand kind of provides the substance for the shoe, not the shoe for the brand. And the same thing is that kind of the profile is that what the person is really invested in. Mm-hmm. So the photo shows that this is really what the person is about. So the photo is more important than what the person actually looks like, as long as the person really takes care to kind of live up to the photo.
Yeah, no, that's a very good way to kind of, I think, conceptualize just, I think, the fact that we're just constantly surrounded by symbols and icons and right. screens. And it's like you can go days without like actually interacting with any tangible object in the real world.
Right.
You can, especially like, I mean, a lot of us were in our homes for a while during the pandemic. And like, I was technically interacting and with a lot of people doing a lot of things, but I wasn't walking very far. I was pretty much staying in the same room. I was
right.
basically touching my phone, touching my
right.
Computer mouse. That's so yeah, you kind of see it.
It's directly, sort of, directly connects with what Baudrillard has called like hyperreality mm-hmm. or what generally called virtuality. These are all different terms for aspects of profelicity.
Hmm. Well, before we end things, do you have any sort of closing remarks?
Not really. No.
Okay.
I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for coming. You can check out Carefree Wandering. It's a very good YouTube channel. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Ben.